Welcome to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Deputy Editor Andrew Knowlton, and joining me today in studio on the 24th floor of One World Trade Center is Belle Cushing, Assistant Editor.
Hi, Andrew.
Is this your first podcast?
First podcast. I'm usually manning the, as Adam likes to say, manning the ones and twos.
Manning the ones. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
And our special guest, all the way from over the pond, Jancis Robinson, who is one of the world's most respected wine critics, I would say, and writer. The only reason that I get the Financial Times on the weekends is to read your column.
Got to tell the editor that.
Okay, I will. I'll send them. But also, perhaps as importantly, more importantly, the just released the fourth edition to the Oxford Companion to Wine. Do you know how many pages it is off the top of your head?
I think it's nearly 900, so three columns, and
wow.
It's nearly a million words.
And the year that the first one came out was?
94.
So this is the fourth. So every 5 or 6 years.
Although this has been the longest period ever since the last edition.
So lots of updates then, too.
Ugh. Yes. 60% of the 4,000 entries have been substantially revised.
All right, we're going to get to the book. Most of, I think, what Belle and I, and I think a lot of the people at the magazine, know about wine is from your writing. Yes.
I'm delighted.
So we're thrilled that you're here. Mm. I wanted to talk about one of the things that I personally love about your writing is you mentioned that you've been doing this a while, but one of the things is, as opposed to some other writers, you seem to not get too stuck with the way things were, and you're more accepting and welcoming, it seems, about new trends. Is that something that comes naturally, or you always try to not be jaded sometimes like other wine people?
I'm just curious, always curious, and I'm always on the side of the underdog, I suppose. So whenever there is a really obscure Ecuadorian Vermentino, I'm the one chasing after it to see whether it really does taste any good at all.
Do you know
you
that?
Had an Ecuadorian Vermentino?
No. I'm going to the extremes of possibility.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that has struck a chord with me. I'm pretty new, being only 25, I'm pretty new to the wine world. But when I first started working in it, I was very intimidated, even as someone who was very excited and wanted to learn as much as possible, by just the sort of status nature of wine. And everybody sort of wants to show off what they know and are a little derisive of certain wines that maybe are not quite up to snuff. And with you, it was just like, no, this is great wine. I want to discover more. And that's
keep
exciting.
Open and call it when you think that a classic isn't performing well, but always be curious. One of my great mentors was my predecessor at the Financial Times as wine correspondent, an amazing guy called Edmund Penning Rousel.
What a wonderful name.
Who had sort of little tufts of hair on his cheeks and, you know, wore a hat and gloves and carried a walking stick and a three-piece suit, but yet was a lifetime subscriber to Marxism Today. He was a sort of real conundrum. And he was never ashamed of saying he didn't know something. He was always curious. And his catchphrase almost was, "How interesting."
Oh, really? Yeah. That's a good line.
And I sometimes wonder how some wine writers ever learn anything, because they talk so much. They're so opinionated, you know, even with wine producers, the chat about what they think. And really, I tend to keep quiet and just or ask the questions and try and be in reception mode. My broadcast mode is when I'm writing,
right.
And I'm in reception mode when I'm interacting with the wine business.
And how important, as somebody who writes about wine constantly and drinks wine, I know for a lot of our listeners out there, when they go to a winery or they do a wine tour, that has like a, I mean, I remember the first time I went to a winery, like, oh, I love this winery now. Even if it was junk wine, that had that relationship. In terms of you writing and finding out what's happening in the wine world, how important is it to you to go to source, to meet the winemaker and have that opportunity?
It's very, very important to put things in context, I think. And I do always feel there are still wine regions, wine districts that I haven't been to, and I always feel very uncomfortable writing about them, because I do think wine is much more than just what's in the glass.
Right.
And there are so many great personalities in wine. I don't know what it is about wine. It seems to attract the quirky, certainly the generous, generally the articulate. And so it's a great part of my job to go traveling. But you can't visit everybody. And right. as the wine world is expanding, it is physically impossible.
You know, the average consumer, do you think they need to know anything about the winery or to enjoy a bottle of wine? I always think about that, you know.
I think to enjoy words written about wine, I think it's difficult to just take in a whole load of tasting notes.
Right,
I think wine
right.
is so much more than that.
Right. right.
And there are so many great stories to be told about wine that I do try to seek them out. And I suppose I'm a bit of a journalist rather than a lyrical writer. So I'm also trying to identify the new trends and share them with readers. But I must say, I think probably the world is getting a bit bored by just tasting notes, actually.
Well, I mean, they don't say that much. I always, tasting notes can sort of easily fall into that trap where it's almost like Mad Libs and you can insert any already accepted tasting note here, like racing or nervy or I used to write emails for sales offers for a wine store. And I sometimes, if I kind of got blocked, it felt literally like I could just pick a word out of a word box and stick it in. And that's really such a shame because there are so many stories and it is really exciting to write about. But sometimes you can just feel like you're filling in the blanks.
I feel very, very lucky, though, that at the moment that actually throughout my 40-year career, I celebrated my 40th anniversary of writing about wine on the 1st of December.
Congratulations.
The explosion, the expansion of the world of wine has really coincided with my career. And, you know, when I started, I was...
Oh, yeah, what was your first wine gig? Yeah.
I was taken on as assistant editor of a wine trade magazine.
Okay.
And that was great, actually, because... not many people read it, so I could make mistakes and nobody noticed. But B, I suppose on the trade side, you get to see how things really are rather than the sort of PR
right.
side of things. And it meant I didn't know anything about wine. And in fact, the publisher who hired me said, we've had a lot of applicants for this job and a great deal of difficulty choosing the right person. Either we choose a trained journalist and teach them all about wine, mm-hmm. or we choose a wine expert and have to teach them how to write. He looked down at my application. He said, you, of course, are neither of these things.
so why did you get hired, do you think?
A year later, went at the kind of Christmas party, and I thought, if there'd been a terrible misunderstanding, I asked him, why did you hire me? Was it because I'd lived in France for a year? Sounds good. Was it because I had done some freelance writing for the Good Food Guide, which was then
right.
Britain's premier restaurant guide? Was it because I was restaurant correspondent of ISIS, the Oxford University wine magazine? No, it's none of those things. Was it, I said rather nervously, because I did some temporary work for a wine company, which was technically true, except that the wine company owned a wine bar in the city and I was basically a barmaid, but I didn't spell that out. No, he said, none of those things. It was because you'd shown that you could organize the skiing side of Britain's biggest travel company. And we saw you were taking a salary drop, and we reckoned that you would, even if you didn't know anything, you would organize yourself to
wow.
know it. In a way, he was right, because I did immediately sign up for the Wine and Spirit Education Trust courses, and I zoomed through those, you know, and then when I was allowed to take the Master of Wine exams, I did that. So I did go to educating myself.
So in our December issue, we have a story that Belle did most of the heavy lifting on, how to be a wine snob without being snobby. And I know you have a book that we can talk about that is coming out in February,
mm-hmm.
which is the 24-Hour Wine Expert. And you can talk about the book through this question. It seems like wine is more fun than it has ever been.
Definitely.
Why is that? Is everyone just like relaxed about it now and like, let's just have a good time?
I think so. I think because there are so many more younger people interested in it, it's
right.
hugely more accessible. And because people like me and people who used to have the field to themselves and hand down pronouncements from on high,
right.
we're not so powerful anymore. You know, it's much, much more democratic. And ordinary wine drinkers can, you know, take a picture or look things up on Vivino and Delectable and do their Instagramming and all that sort
right.
of thing. 'Cause when I started out, honestly, from a little village in northern England and not being brought up with wine, if you said the word wine, it had to have audible quotation marks around it. You know? Wine, which just isn't the case anymore, is it?
No.
I mean, even in Britain, in our most down-market soap operas, people just pour themselves a glass of wine as a kind of little dramatic interlude without right. any comment whatsoever. So it's wonderful. I'm delighted by that, I have to say.
So there's a few things, I know, Belle, that you wanted to ask Jancis about that we kind of covered and how she sees wine becoming more fun based on those kind of principles.
Yeah, it seems like there are a few trends that I know you've written about some of them and would love to hear your take that sort of contribute to wine being so much more accessible and so much more fun. And one of them is this is actually the act of buying wines. We have access to so much more, and almost every city has a very cute little wine shop where you can go in there and make friends with the wine clerk, and that'll be your sort of go-to neighborhood place.
Absolutely. I mean, even though I've spent 40 years earning my living selling information about wine, sometimes giving it away, but ideally selling it, I always say, if somebody says, I want to know more about wine, what shall I do? I always say, establish a rapport with a local wine retailer. It's just like a bookstore, really, isn't it? You go in and you tell them what you've read, what you've enjoyed, and you rely on them to recommend something else that's going to suit your taste.
In New York, we say your wine store is more important than your shrink. You know? So you have somebody that you can always go to. That's the biggest thing, is because if I know... You can learn whatever you want about wine, but you're still not going to know as much as somebody who does it for a living, you know, I think.
Exactly. And it is in their interests to give you good advice. And if they don't, then you move on to the next store.
Right. And it's a nice feeling to go into a shop knowing that every wine is a quote-unquote good wine. And so any exploration you're doing within it is just figuring out new grapes or new producers, new regions. And then another trend, which I find us sort of, I have sort of a hard time defending, and but I'm definitely a fan, is lower alcohol wines, and how, you know, we don't see these huge 16% big.
They're out of fashion, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. And so why do you think that is?
I think it's for every action there's a reaction,
right.
And the world went for let's have wines
bigger
as powerful
better.
As yeah. possible. Yeah. And it was inevitable there'd be a reaction against that. So it's a pleasure to find wines that are a lower alcohol but that are just chock full of flavor.
And I think the poster child, at least that in the United States, that's just gone up increasingly in popularity is the Beaujolais Village.
Mm-hmm.
Being low alcohol, kind of easy drinking wines. And it took us so long to get over to the Nouveau thing.
Well, it's fabulous to hear that, because the poor old Beaujolais growers have had life. It's been very tough for them. So I'm thrilled if there's much more being exported to this country. I don't think we're quite there yet. So,
Okay.
But you're obviously the trailblazers. So
yeah,
we'll be there.
What is your take on the New York wine market versus the London or UK versus America in general?
I think you're a little much more old world centric than we are. I think we are... I'm quite surprised. I mean, you've got some wonderful wines here, but I'm quite surprised by how difficult it is, how you've turned completely off Australia, as though the whole country...
It's a bad word now.
I know. And I feel so sorry for these. You know, there are some very good wine producers in Australia. It's just not the case that it's all about Barossa Shiraz and Yellowtail. You know,
right.
There are some...
Yeah.
Well, I've actually been... I think I've been selling this to Andrew a little bit. I've heard about these new producers. There's one importer, actually, called Vine Street.
Oh, right,
which is bringing
yes.
in a lot of young...
The new
of,
wave.
Yeah, the yeah. new wave. Yeah. The sort of new California, now the new Australia, Adelaide Hills.
But that's...
And all
I mean,
that.
Belle, you bring up a good point. That's something... Distribution of wine is so difficult, and the U.S. is such a big place that what you can get in California or Texas or New York sometimes is
completely
different.
Yeah.
And one of the points that we make in our story is, and you can say if this is something that you do, or I mean, you probably know all of them, but you know, you used to go in and look at the front label of a wine bottle to see who the grower was and the year. But now I've told a lot of people who don't know wine, if you don't even want to bother, is turn the label around and see who the importer is.
That's good advice.
Because if you're buying a Kermit Lynch here or a Rosenthal or...
Louis Dresner.
Yeah.
Now there are a bunch of younger importers, Zev Rovine, these Wine Streets, Luxio Massal, who... And if you get to know their portfolios, and it's almost like the same relationship that you have with the wine shop. You sort of know their personality. You figure you trust them generally. And then you can pick up any Louis Dresner wine and feel pretty confident you're going to like
it. It'll be pretty funky, but pretty good, carefully selected.
But do you know, are we getting some of these wines that you're very excited about from the New World? Do you know if we're getting a lot of those into the United States?
I have been looking, because I've been organizing one or two tastings, and I thought there's no point in me showing the sort of wines that you're already familiar with. So I've been particularly trying to show these. And yes, there are one or two specialist importers.
Is there, just for my own, is there one, like one of the Shiraz, you know, producers that you're really excited about that we can find here? Or?
Well, funnily enough, I, you know, like most people, I can only remember as far back as this morning. And what I was writing about this morning was a guy who has just been voted Australia's winemaker of the year, who's he's called Steve Pannell, and his label is S C for Charlie Pannell, PANNELL. And he really is very thoughtful and forward thinking, and realizing that Australia can't go on picking super ripe grapes and has to actually plant more. He's experimenting a lot with port grapes, for instance, which are used to very, very high temperatures and things. And his wines have the most fantastic energy in them. He's making them very reductively. He's bottling them quite early. He's not giving them new oak. I would hope that he's got a US importer.
Okay.
So he'd be in the forefront. I mean, he'd be one. And he doesn't, but like most wine countries now, there's also the kind of, not quite lunatic fringe, but the fringe pushing the envelope perhaps just a little bit too far.
A little too far, right.
But he's got the balance right, I'd say.
Right. I feel like one factor in the US is that we spent so long trying to convince people that it wasn't all about Napa or, you know, big Shirazes.
Or Sauvignon Blanc.
You know, our Argentinian Malbecs, that wasn't the only thing. And just the wheel moves slowly. And so we did that for so long. And now you have to sort of convince people again that, it's not just...
It'll be very, very interesting to see what happens in the medium term to Napa Valley Cabernet, won't it? Because from my view, because I've got a pretty global view, I think, even though I'm based in London, because both JancisRobinson.com and the Financial Times have a very global readership.
Yes.
And, of course, my books, not just the Oxford Companion to Wine, but the World Atlas of Wine, and have sales globally. And it does seem to me as though the only little bit in the world which is withstanding this trend to making fresher wines, lower alcohol wines, is Napa Valley, actually Napa Valley Cabernet. You know, you'd be a fool to say port has to be lower alcohol. You know, there are certain styles that that suit higher alcohol. And so perhaps Napa Valley Cabernet will always be a pretty full-on wine. However, if you think about the examples that were made in the 70s, 60s, I've tasted the odd one from the 40s, they were stunning, and they weren't heavy and alcoholic. You know,
they
lots
were more
of 12.5% alcohol wines that have stood the test of time.
Speaking of California, it's a little early here at the World Trade Center, but perhaps we can pour just a smidgen.
What are we drinking?
So this is a Pet Nat. Speaking of trends,
yes.
And new additions,
new
to the Oxford
entry
Companion.
In the Oxford Companion to Wine. Yes,
this is a Pet Nat from Napa. So Not Your Napa Cab by Michael Cruz.
I don't know Michael Cruz.
He's sort of seems to be somewhat of a darling in the new Napa world. I haven't tried this wine yet, so it'll be
Let's open it.
New
and
for
it everyone. And it and it does have a just for the readers listeners at home, readers, listeners, viewers, it does have a crown cap, which is the bottle cap that you get like on a Coca-Cola bottle. So Jancis, for people who don't know, and we can segue into the fourth edition of the Oxford Companion to Wine. Every year, it's one of my favorite sections. You have the new edition, the new terms, the dictionary that makes it
in. There are 300 of them.
300. And one of them is Pet Nat.
Yeah.
So give us the down low, I guess, A, what is Pet Nat? And then what's the decision? Like, who decides? You do, probably. Like, what makes it in that edition?
Yeah. Well, Pet Nat or Petillon Naturel, which is its long-winded name, where the fermentation is natural in the bottle, and it's the perfect wine for middle of the working day.
Now, are you a fan of them in general, or are you kind of?
I think they're fun. They're
nothing to think deeply about, right?
Not too serious. Yeah, 10% alcohol. That's what I was looking at. Right. Yeah, and a pretty pale kind of
cheers.
Pale salmon color. Does he say what grapes it's made of? Oh, very trendy. Mm.
And for the listeners, could you give a little Oxford synopsis of what this grape is?
Well, now, what was it?
What was the grape again?
Valdigue, which is Valdigue. Almost impossible to find in its native southwest France, I think. And it used to be called something. It's only relatively recently been identified as that. As for the decision about what's new and what goes in, the editor's decision is final. I suppose I just become aware of terms that have become more prevalent, phenomena. Sometimes it's a question of things being renamed. For instance, in the third edition, we had an entry under random oxidation, which was the largely Australian term for the horrible phenomenon whereby particularly white Burgundy, but generally white wines, would suddenly go brown and lose their fruit. And nowadays, we more frequently call it premature oxidation or premox. So obviously there has to be a little entry under random oxidation saying see premature oxidation. So as editor of the Oxford Companion to Wine, you become an absolute whiz at cross-references. That's the key. And you do need quite a logical brain to slice this massive amorphous world of wine into topics and entries and how the entries relate to each other.
Right. It's fascinating because you'll have a very technical term like premature oxidation, but then also urban wineries, because that's definitely a growing trend.
And Belle, you wanted to ask Jancis about one. We were talking about tasting notes before and the words we used to describe it. And one of the words that we've seen when you're talking to a somm is a big word.
Minerality.
The M word.
The M word.
Yes. You knew exactly where I was going.
What is that? What does it mean, I guess? And how did it become so damn sexy to say, I like a lot of minerality in my wine?
It's interesting, isn't it? And it is such an imprecise term. And that's what we've tried to get across in the quite long entry on minerality.
We use it in our article, and our research director came up to me, and she was like, I just can't find a definition for this word. I can't fact-check minerality.
Quite, exactly. Well, it basically covers any flavor that is not fruity, not veggy, not animally, not woody, but is in the kind of spectrum from something stony, something warm, earthy, something even sulfide-y. Anything that might possibly have something to do with rock, stones, or chemicals, actually.
So my wife is Norwegian, and I saw that Norway was in there, and I was like, oh, I got to read this entry. And then, Belle, can you read? It's kind of this depressing little entry about...
Norway has a vineyard. Norway has a vineyard on the southern coast in Kristiansand, although the Pinot Noir and Riesling vines have difficulty ripening a crop.
So have you had that?
It's pretty far south.
Yeah.
Well, it was planted with help from the very gifted Rheinhessen wine producer, Klaus-Peter Keller. And he just keeps sending me pictures from this poor bedraggled vineyard where the birds get there first. And it'll happen one of these days, but it needs a supercharge of climate change, I think. Help it on its way.
We'll all be gone, hopefully, by the time that happens.
Yeah. They'll only be making wine in Alaska and Norway.
Yeah.
So you're also publishing a much smaller book. This Oxford Companion to Wine is enormous. Your new book is much smaller. And it's sort of a guide for young people drinking wine.
So the 24-hour wine expert came about because of our 24-year-old daughter, who was fed up with all her friends liking to drink wine, not knowing much about it, and saying and having lots and lots of questions about it, and saying, hey, your mother's a wine writer, ask her this, ask her that. I just felt there are so many people who don't want a great big million-word Oxford Companion to Wine and want a shortcut to the sort of practical things to avoid making a fool of yourself. And so I've written this book, but it's actually been quite difficult because if you spent 40 years learning about something, it's really quite difficult to pare it down. And it's been really useful to have an editor who doesn't know anything about wine but is the perfect target market.
Did you get your daughter to weigh in on?
Oh, yes. She read every word and kept occasionally saying, "Mom, don't use that word."
Yeah, I can't wait till that. I've been sort of doing an ad hoc version of that for all of my roommates, past and present, because they're like, "Oh, Belle knows about wine. She'll bring home bottles, and you can tell us all about it." And now they'll see a wine and be like, "Oh, that's a Belle wine." Now I know, but I think that would be a more complete course.
So before we let you go, we do have our lightning round.
I don't like the sound of this.
That I'm going to ask you.
Am I going to have to have memorized every word in the Oxford Companion?
No, yes. No.
Down to the page.
This is not as smart as the Oxford Companion. And you have to answer them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll give you one or two if you really don't want to. Mm-hmm. And just one word answers is great. Crown cap or screw top?
Screw cap.
Ice in your wine is permissible always, never, or only in what situation?
When the wine's too hot.
So it's okay to put ice in your wine?
Yeah, it would be a bit silly. The trouble is ice usually has a rather nasty taste.
Yes.
So be careful of your ice. But I've been known to put ice in. In fact, I've done it very recently, like in the last 2 days, somewhere here in New York.
Awesome. That's good to hear. So in terms of tasting notes, cat pee or forest floor aromatics?
Well, I'd rather taste the forest floor aromatics.
What is the most ridiculous tasting note that you have come across?
I can't...
Or something you wrote and then had to erase it because you're like, no, I can't do
too
that.
Much, too far.
Well, I did find one and I didn't have to look very far because there are lots like this, but I wrote an article recently including my thoughts about how unhelpful long lists of flavors are, because we all have different tasting equipment, and I think for the novice wine drinker, it's probably very off-putting to be given 10 different flavors that they'll never ever find in a wine. So if I can remember, there was grilled watermelon, there was oolong tea, there was black raspberry. There was fennel. No, fennel seeds.
These are all for the same wine?
All the same wine. But this is just the start. Did I say sandalwood?
No, sandalwood.
There were 10, anyway. And those are just the only ones that I can remember.
River Cafe or Kitty Fisher's?
Do you know, I've yet to go to Kitty Fisher's because it opened at more or less the same time as our son's second restaurant, Portland. And so I've got a little... against it.
Oh, your son owns... You know, I was just looking up London restaurants, actually. Well, I'm going there in a few weeks, but also because I wanted to throw some London restaurant questions at you. And I saw it. It's so beautiful. I didn't realize that was your son.
Well, it's just been given a Michelin star after only 9 months, which is crazy.
No pressure.
Crazy.
Beer or cocktails?
Cocktails.
What's your drink when you're not drinking wine?
I like acidity. So I don't often... but. I have cocktails. I love Pisco Sour, which admittedly is perhaps not a cocktail. And I'd like all the kind of Tom Collins-y.
Citrusy.
Yes, yeah. The odd Caipirinha.
Tetra Paks or boxed wine?
Tetra Pak. I think they're really sensible, Tetra Pak. And boxed is fine. But I'd love to see more wine producers who are selling everyday wine using Tetra Paks. I think it's just very sensible. There's no sense in shipping wine around the world in something as fragile and expensive to make as a bottle.
Wow. You heard it here first. Do you drink wine every single day?
Afraid so.
For how long?
Oh, about an hour. You mean for how long have I drunk wine?
Yes.
Every single day.
40 years?
40.
Right.
45?
You never take a break.
She has me beat, I think. I try, but I don't know.
Well, very occasionally, if we go on holiday somewhere like Egypt or India.
Where you can't drink wine.
And even there, I try desperately.
Do you try? You're not just so desperate to get away from wine.
No, I'm never desperate to get away from wine. I'm always curious. So yes, certainly, traveling in both those countries, I've tried the local stuff. And certainly when we were there, the local Indian was better than the local Egyptian. But I'm told Egyptian wine has got better.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. That is Belle Cushing. I'm Andrew Knowlton. And today we've been joined by the most knowledgeable Jancis Robinson. Thank you, Jancis.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The This podcast is brought to you by executive producer Belle Cushing and project manager Carrie Polis, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. The theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. Tune in every Wednesday for a new episode on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.